So let's get with it. Better be seeing some underpants up here. We're going to be real mad at you. I hate to think that Los Angeles was the only place in the United States where we couldn't get any donations. So far, the American city that holds the award is Chicago. Underpants Bonanza in Chicago. And San Diego, two nights ago, was really a bonanza also. It was fantastic. So, whip them off, get them up here. Meanwhile, let me tell you who's playing the show for you tonight. This is Ike Willis on guitar and vocals. Tommy Mars on keyboards. Steve Vai on guitar and light blue hair. Vinny Colaiuta on drums. Arthur Barrow on bass. Bob Harris on keyboards, trumpet, and high vocals. And the legendary Ray White on guitar and vocals. All right, Los Angeles, ready?
All right, that's good.
Hey, two. And they're still warm. Thank you.
These executives have fluked the fuck out of me. And there's still a long time to go before I paid my debt to society. And all I ever really wanted to do was play the guitar and bend the string like Reen Tootie Tootie Noonie Noonie. I've got it. I'll be sullen and withdrawn. I'll dwindle off into the twilight realm of my own secret thoughts. I'll lay on my back here till dawn in a semi-catatonic state and dream of guitar notes that would irritate an executive kind of guy. Well, I guess that one did the trick. They only could have heard it. Half a dozen of them would have strangled while they were sucking on each other's dick. Yeah, but that was only a bunch of imaginary notes I played. Just a little extra something to keep me going from day to day. And that's okay. I'll be getting out of here pretty soon. Then I won't have to live in this ugly fucking room. I can't wait to see what it's like on the outside now. I can't wait to see. Like on the outside now.
Okay. Let's bring this in. Okay, one, two, three. No. I think you're there, Bert.
Yes, I'm here, Bob.
And Roxy's there. I think Eben dropped off, so maybe she's coming back. What did you think of that music, you two?
Which one?
Fine composition. Fine composition.
Fine composition. Now, in my phone, it goes blurry. It started to distort. Are you guys getting that, how you're listening to it? Maybe it's clear all the way through on the computer, no slight wavering.
It was clear for me. Well.
Right. So yeah, I think it's my phone. But I went onto the computer, but it's still, it starts getting a windy effect, and it sort of distorts slightly. But at least you guys got the clear effect. So that was a nice guitar solo, nice intro by Ike Willis. Pretty good quality recording. Wouldn't you say? I mean, the fidelity of it. Would you like to hear another recording, or shall we get into it? You want to start talking? What do you say, Roxy? You want to?
I just say the text that Ike was singing is pretty radical for the 80s.
Yeah. Maybe I should get the. Here comes Eben. I hope that's you, Eben, right? Eben? Click on your mute.
Yeah, but maybe we can start talking and then you.
Hello?
No, that's Eben. Someone's there. Okay, Eben. Okay, Eben, you're here?
Oh, I can hear you. Yeah, I just got back.
You got to make your phone better. Yeah, make it clear you're a bit distorted. We can't have you distorted, so fix your phone, make it perfect.
Gotcha.
Are you in a car?
I'm doing my best, sir.
Yeah, are you in a car?
No, my headset went down. And no, I'm at home. But I just, all I can do is talk into my laptop wherever the bloody mic is. I'm not sure. So I'm just shouting at my laptop because I don't have another mic.
Okay.
My headset isn't working. I'm sorry.
Okay,
I'm just
that's
shouting
good.
At it.
If you... You're pretty clear, so just stay where you are. Did you hear the music?
Yes.
Good. Any comment on it?
Oh.
We're far out.
Well,
yeah,
I think it...
Did you like it, Eben? Was it pleasant for you?
It's interesting... Yes, but at the same time, it's like it's medicine. It's medicine with a message.
Yes,
and they're in a sense trying to play around with the natural function of the 60 hertz rhythm of our hearts and bodies to bring a little debauchery and fun and knowledge, and so. It's certainly an acquired taste, and I really I appreciate that. And I just to think that that was going on in the 60s, 70s was, I mean, mind-blowing, really. Great.
Yeah. I'll read you the lyrics. This is, see, Joe's been arrested for playing music. So he's in jail, and he's in with all the music industry executives. They were put in jail, too. So that's why the first sign of this particular song, which is, Outside Now, he's looking forward to being released from jail. So the lyric instruction says, Joe, somewhat exhausted. Now here's the reason. So the first line is, these executives have pluked the fuck out of me. So he's been anally reamed for hours or days, right? That's the opening sentence. And because Zappa had his own mail order business, and he wasn't relying on record companies,
He was working for O'Fanil.
Yeah, he was working for me, and no censorship could be applied. So he says, "These Joe, poor Joe says, these executives have pluked the fuck out of me, and there's still a long time to go before I've paid my debt to society. And all I ever really wanted to do was play the guitar and bend the string like, re-toot-dee-toot-dee-toot-dee-toot. That's the lyrics, bending the string. Re-toot-dee-toot. He goes, I've got it. I'll be sullen and withdrawn. I'll dwindle off into the twilight realm of my own secret thoughts. I'll lay on my back here till dawn in a semi-catatonic state and dream of guitar notes that would irritate an executive kind of guy." And then the narrator, I think, says this. And sure enough, Joe dreams up a few of those guitar notes that every executive despises. Those low ones. Now, Frank was playing low ones in the song. Every exec knows it's only the records with the high squealy notes that get to be hit, in brackets, except for Duane Eddy. And he did low notes. Yeah. So then Joe says, that was the central scrutinizer commenting on Joe. And then Joe comes back and says, well, I guess that one did the trick. If they only could have heard it, half a dozen of them would have strangled while they were sucking on each other's dick. But that was just a bunch of imaginary notes I played, just a little extra something to keep me going from day to day. That's okay. I'll be getting out of here pretty soon. Then I won't have to live in this ugly fucking room. I can't wait to see what it's like on the outside now. And then it says, the central scrutinizer says, and Joe just lays there dreaming imaginary guitar notes for years on end. Until finally they let him out. So that's the lyrics. Is that mind blowing ahead of its time, Eben?
Well, it's an allegory of the frequency.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, it's frequency modulation, which is McLuhan said to Harold Innes. Innes, he wrote a letter in 1951 to Harold Innes, who was his competitor in media ecology. And he says, we're moving to FM, frequency modulation. That's what he said to Harold Innes. What are you saying, Roxy?
Yes, because I said today it's about electronic frequencies. And most of these constructions, the pyramids and the cathedrals, are actually like big resonating boxes. And the concept of music by Ion goes beyond the fa sol la music we always think about.
Right.
He talks about the word, the rhapsode, the new song, the spoken word as a type of music. And also the thing that Pauline Olivers would call the quantum hearing. The frequencies affecting at a molecular, cellular level, the communication of frequencies and sound at many levels. We're communicating with frequencies and the drops
okay, Roxy,
actually.
Let me explain the importance of Pauline. She just quoted Pauline Oliveros. You'll see in my the Zappa interview we did in 1988. There's a big tribute to Pauline Oliveros by Zappa. She had came up with some ideas about sounds above hearing and below hearing that were affecting what we did hear. And Zappa gave great tribute to her.
Yes,
now,
she said the frequency in between will cause this parallel world experience.
Yeah,
like
now,
the result of
Roxy just went and saw Pauline speak yesterday in Berlin. And this is, she's an old lady now. So she's quoting Pauline. Are you quoting what she said yesterday, Roxy?
Well, not exactly, but that's her big thing, how sound and the way we listen, the quantum hearing, affects you in many levels. And that's here the thing with Joe. He says, I'm finally free. It's like the frequency
yeah.
that has to be amplified at the cellular level to start communicating and changing with all these cymatics effects. It has been liberated. And that's the thing we saw, for example, in the magic flute. Mozart changed changes the myth of Orfeo and Eurydice, that was the favorite piece of Joyce, because in the myth of Orfeo and Eurydice, Orfeo doesn't make it. He convinces the gods to give the spirit of Eurydice back so she can live again, but they don't make it. And Mozart changes this myth, and in his opera, The Magic Flute, the couple makes it. So for him, as a composer, he changes that, and he says, yes, music. And that was the thing with Orfeo and Eurydice that I think attracted Joyce so much, that this idea, because he was actually a musician, that music defeats death, that music makes you eternal. And that's the thing that I've been saying all the time about the frequency, that it's an amplification of some frequency. And the music is not only the fa sol la, but it's the music, the hearing we do with all our bodies, the tactile music, in many levels. So for me, when he says, I'm finally free, is this frequency that we are finally hearing.
Yes.
With the completion.
Right. In the lyrics, he says, I'll lay on my back here till dawn in a semi-catatonic state and dream of guitar notes that would irritate an executive kind of guy. That's a simplified version of Uncle Meat looking for frequencies to alter whole populations. But it's right here. He wants to find particular notes that would irritate. So the idea of massaging a person with the frequencies is in there. Now, I want a little background on Pauline Oliveros. When Gerd Stern, who became a famous artist in the 60s and 70s, he went out to California many times. He went out there in 63, just before the Kennedy assassination, and he went to the San Francisco Tape Center, T-A-P-E, and there were some avant-garde people there doing, I guess, electronic music and other things. And one of the people there that took Gerd in, and Gerd got them to help make an art environment that he put on out there right around the time Kennedy was assassinated, was Pauline Oliveros. She got her start at the San Francisco Tape Center. So, you know, that's 50 years ago Gerd knew her, and Gerd is involved with us here in Irondom. And then Pauline does her compositions, installations, whatever it was that Zappa was impressed with, however that was made. And then she goes on. But now Roxy was laughing that where she ended up, this sort of pretty important composer, now is teaching public audiences how to meditate with an emphasis on the music metaphor. Like, she makes a lot out of subatomic particles and music, right, Roxy?
Well, because it's an ancient tradition. It's in our genes. It's an instinct that music connects you to the non-physical.
Yeah.
So in all religions and traditions, music is used as a very important need to connect, to get in trance, to for the ecstasy, which is to go somewhere else.
Yeah. But and here's the thing about Pauline. Why does she have to provide this? Yes, Eben. Yes, Eben.
In talking about music, well, since you have, like, the African Brigade here, we could just talk about the drum and all the multifaceted and how interesting it was, because it's a spiked drum. So not only do you have frequency, but you have attenuation and just how long it stays in your system, because it's not electrified. But what I wanted to ask was, did Frank Zappa have a disdain for the audience?
No. He made music for himself, and it was invited. Anybody who was interested in it could enjoy it or engage it. He was interested in those that liked it. And he said, if you don't like it, that's okay. He's not imposing on people who don't like it. So he says, all this music is me exploring what I want to hear, and if you like it, then sit in and maybe a dialogue will happen. So that's what he said privately. Hey, wait a minute. That's what he said in some interviews. On other interviews, he says, I'm not an entertainer, I'm a therapist. And he starts talking the way Roxy's talking. So he quadriphenically did not limit his purpose to one statement.
Yes, okay, because Evan? He was a mystic, and he was aware of that power of music to turn on people and to bring them to ecstasy. And one of his big tools in his agenda was audience participation, and that was the thing with the old traditions. The old rituals were tactile. Everybody participated, and they had orgies and took drugs and played music. It was not only like praying or singing. It was really very extreme. And in a way, he's retrieving those old deletion mysteries type of reconnecting. And this brings us to the groupies, because he saw that there were some crazy new phenomena going on in the 60s. He saw people were being turned on in their creativity, in their exploration for freedom of expression and exploration of their sexuality, and he was really interested in those things. And one of the aspects of this new freaking out with the frequencies, with the electric environment, was the phenomenon of the groupies. And he was asked to write about a book about politics. Phenomenon, and he said, a happy nation sucks, because he said, these women are exploring their sexuality, are free, are more creative, and they're going to end up with the average little man, but these little men are going to be happier, because they're going to be fucking more and better. And this is going to be good for the economy, and this is going to be good for the country. And that was his thesis.
That's right. He called it suck power. You had black power, gray power. He called it suck power, and he encouraged women, young women, to fuck all the old executives who were corrupt and ruining society with their backwards attitudes. So he thought that women should go in there and fuck the executives. He called that suck power. And then he said, because these women fucked around a lot, these young women, they'd be better at it, and they'd make their working fellow labor workers, husbands, happier, because they'd be better fucks than the repressed society before that.
And in a way, he was not that wrong. Because
he was not what? He was not what?
not,
and it's put on the wall.
The best music was made, the best rock music was made during that.
Like,
I'm a season fucking...
No, wait a minute.
In the 80s,
I did not hear what Roxy... Just a minute, Evan. I did not hear anything you said, Roxy. What were you talking about?
Yes, that he was right, because the best bands, the best rock bands, were the bands in the 60s and the 70s, where there was so much fucking going on. Then came AIDS, and Frank Zappa said the bands now look like they just came out of the fridge.
Yeah,
you know, like we had a robot.
Yeah,
and more like posing and doing like playback. They were not
right,
even playing.
Right.
But he recognized that there was something there going on, and McLuhan will explain this phenomenon like an aspect of the effects of the electronic environment, because the woman. Zappa made a lot of interviews thousands of hours with the groupies, and he will collect all their diaries and all the, their papers, and he really documents his groupies. And some will say they were turned on by the music, like in such a way that they wanted to fuck the musicians.
Yeah.
So.
Well, let me fill that in a couple of points here, Roxy. First of all, Eben, did you want to say something, Eben?
I see his music as being ahead of the time, but his philosophy. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. His philosophy is archaic. I mean, his music's ahead of the time, but this whole thing about fucking and all that stuff is just a flash in the pan. The music that came after him in the 80s and 90s, even though it was more narrative, pierced and really brought the politics forward. And I, you know, as somebody said to me, what is it for a man to love? And they said when they look at a woman, they never see a woman. What they see is the reflection in the woman's eyes. And him going to his groupies, all he was looking for was him and what the groupies were saying. This is just what's coming to me, you know, from this. And
I'm going to give you some counter facts. These are things none of you know. Okay, here's a fact.
I think there were both aspects on that he was sometimes a macho and he was flattered by.
Okay, here's what happened.
But there was more behind that. There was really much more.
Yeah, of course, I'm gonna give you some information to expand your view here, all of you. So in the Life magazine article, he says these young people, consumers of rock, felt it in their bones. He says, the new musical effect is not going through the ear, it's going through the bone. And he called it bone conduction, which would be my version of McLuhan's tactile visceral. So then he himself did not do anything with these groupies. He took them as a sociological phenomenon. Now, where you can read the actual details is get Pauline Butcher's book, Zappa's Secretary. And no one has ever written in detail the period 67 to 70, that three-year period where Frank basically was very charismatic, but you didn't have access to his scene too much. You had to luckily get in there. So nobody knew what Frank was doing. Well, Pauline Butcher, about what was going on. She was a British woman, a conservative British woman, who got the job of being Frank's secretary, and she was totally shocked by what was going on around Frank. But she got used to it. And years later, you know, 40 years later, she decided to take the letters to her mother and made a book out of it, all the diaries. So she gives the details how she was given the job to manage the groupies, the GTOs, these girls together outrageously. And so she talks about taking them around to record companies, talks about their love life and everything. Frank didn't do anything. As a matter of fact, he first hired Pauline to help him write this book idea for talking about politics, because people were looking at Frank as a spokesman for the young people. He's a little older and smarter, so the book publisher said, well, let's get Zappa to write a book to express what the under 30-year-olds are thinking. And he never got to do that because he got distracted, and Pauline was going to help write that book, or at least edit it, but they got distracted with the groupie project, which just dumped into his lap. And he didn't do anything much with them. He got them to write, but Pauline did the work with them. So you want to read Pauline's life with the groupies that made the groupie papers and all that. And a lot of it got aborted and screwed up and knocked out, and the groupies got ripped off by record company people, TV people. But Frank, I imagine he was giving advice in there, but he was not involved with him on a sexual level. Now, 20 years later, early 90s, when virtual reality came out, and people started looking at things on what? You're saying something in response to me? Eben.
It's not necessary for him to have sexual relations with them.
Okay. Yeah, but here's the point. He's looking at them as a journalist. Hold it, Eben. He's looking at them as a journalist. Now, here's a key point. When virtual reality came out in the early early 90s with Jaron Lanier's virtual reality goggles, there were a bunch of people trying to do sex, cyber sex, with these goggles. And Zappa said, this is the most absurd extension of sex. He says, first of all, sex is an absurd act. If you imagine, if you see any two people having sex, it's the most ridiculous, almost humiliating situation. He started talking about it like a Puritan. Like he was disgusted with a sexual act or observing it in other people. And this shocked Pauline Butcher. She reports in the book that she didn't realize that Frank was so, in a way, not the horny guy that people projected on him. He was actually like the scientist, the journalist, looking at the sexual revolution as anthropology. So you've got to include that in your assessment of what he was doing with groupies. He was not the band members. The band members had all kinds of stories. They fucked mud sharks. They got groupies with brushes, hairbrushes, and all kinds of different songs about the different groupies. But Zappa never did any of it. He was just told by the band members what they had done the night before, and he would write a song about it because he was a journalist reporting it. So let's remember that Zappa, much like McLuhan, was clinically looking for the causes of this phenomenon. He thought it was society should have more open-minded about it, and politically as a joke, since everybody was running around with black power, yippie power, he said, well, how about suck power? So, of course, he's being a manipian to recommend that people go fuck these old executives. I don't know if he really expected them to do it, but it was a way of being a different position. But on my tiny note chart, he's under the quadrant, the McLuhan quadrant, called sex, because there was a definite sexual explosion in the late 60s because of the tactile effect of TV obliterating the conditioning of literate man. And this is well spelled out in the Playboy interview. So you want to look at why Zappa is being a journalist, how he's being a journalist, and how McLuhan's doing the same thing in Playboy. You don't want to project silly, like Roger Plant, like Pamela DeBar, the main groupie who becomes the most famous groupie, who was one of the GTOs, in this new interview she just put out recently. She talks about the guys, Sable and this other Lisa or somebody. These two young 13-year-old groupies came in and changed the scene in the 70s. They were mean. They weren't friends like the GTOs. And she and Pamela says she doesn't like the scene when these little kids came in. Now, they were 13 years old, and everybody was saying, well, nobody's going to screw these little kids. They're underage. And she says her friend said, David Bowie never did that. And she says, yeah, I knew David Bowie. And yeah, you're telling me he didn't? He did. And so there's this whole different quality of these musicians fucking anything that moves, no matter what age. That is not, and they're doing what you're talking about, Evan. They're looking for their reflection in the eyes or something, or they're just being perversely exploring their chemical body. You can't put Zappa on that level. That's what I'm saying. Let's not bring Zappa on that level. That's just the most bands, most pop culture bands are formed by guys to get laid, right? That is generally the motive. Not many of them are really interested in music as a science or art form like Mozart, Beethoven, and Zappa were. That's the difference. So I'll shut up now.
On Zappa, for example, was just interest in...
Okay, wait a minute. Roxy, let Eben speak because she started this part of the argument. Go ahead, Eben.
There's just something in his experimentation, and maybe it is just, I mean, I didn't bring anything up about sex with the groupies, but anybody who was on stage that does something for themselves and then only, just looks to who likes it, has a pretty healthy ego. And so I'm only saying this, because I'm just looking at the man behind the music and trying to, figure out why such discordant kind of aggressive and but yet enlightened discussion, but in a form that is very... challenging and off-putting. And so I'm just trying to figure out the man behind it. And so when you said that he looks at it like a journalist, well, then I that gives me a better that helped a lot, because then I can understand that he was he's a little detached from
the trappings of things. So detached, He considered the act of sex, if he ever saw it,
right,
as absurd. It did not turn him on. Now, he had girlfriends, all kinds of girlfriends, but he wasn't running around trying to get laid, like the other band members were.
No, he was actually a workaholic, and
yes,
he was interested in the expression, the creativity of people that were not presented in the mainstream, and he wanted to promote
right,
that, the creativity of
yeah,
of freaks, that would be how the society would call them. And part of his rebellion against all this establishment was sometimes being vulgar and being provocative. And he got into the GTOs because one of the girls was the nanny. He shared before a house, like in a commune type of housing,
yeah,
with six girls. And two of them were working for him. One was like the nanny, and then they will meet
yeah,
and dance at his house. And they could not sing, they could not play, but he found interesting that this bunch of women were trying to express something.
Mm-hmm.
And he just wanted to present the creativity of these crazy girls, because they were all very freaky. You can go to the Wikipedia and read about each of them. And their lives is sort of, yeah, like runaways. And
yeah,
and actually, for example, he stopped the project because they were into drugs. I think he found them with heroin or something.
Yeah.
So, but he was really interested in the fact that there were all these minorities, these freaks, trying to be creative and express themselves and explore many aspects that had been repressed for millennia, like sexuality, freedom of expression,
yeah,
and
for women,
especially women, and this type of sort of trying to gain the power back started with the suffragettes. First, they wanted to vote, to have political equality. And women were not allowed to have property, to have an... parents? Well, to get things from... So
yeah, they were not having inheritance. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, inheritance.
Right.
And many, many things. So it was a gradual taking the power back that in the 60s ended with this sexual revolution because of the contraceptives. Women could
yeah,
at last have sex and don't get pregnant. So that gave them a lot of freedom in in that aspect. Of course, there were many bad sides because many did become prostitutes, and there was a lot of drug abuse. A lot of them were also abused in many ways by the rock stars. But it's part of this phenomenon of the liberation. And it was not only women, it was also gays and other groups, ethnic groups trying also to be visible, to get access to the media or
right. Okay, so let's now, Eben, what does that evoke for you? What kind of thoughts?
well, that It is, you know, it's always interesting to see someone during their times. And, you know, you guys, Bobby knew him, and Roxy's getting into, but we haven't heard from Bert yet. But anyway.
No, but wait. So before we bring Bert in, before we bring Evan. Here's what I want to add, Evan, is that McLuhan was criticized in the 60s.
Yeah.
He would, like, take the hippie phenomenon, popular fads, and sociologists and serious historians saying, this guy is just looking at weird, trendy behavior that might last 18 months and making it a sign of the change in human nature. They thought he was taking a superficial sociological fads and trying to build a theoretical, serious, philosophical case out of it. Now, what's interesting is that Zappa was doing the same thing. He was dealing with weird phenomena, and he was studying the effects of this new electronic global theater on young people. That's what he specialized in. Zapping, McLuhan included young people, but McLuhan also included economics and corporations, which Zappa did occasionally later himself. So they both were studying the effects of this new environment, and McLuhan called the new environment a tactile mosaic, and Zappa called it frequencies, you know, sound frequencies. But they both knew it was more than just sound. So you got these two sociologists working in different environments, and Zappa is looking at every new superficial phenomenon as indicative of something. So every 18 months, McLuhan would make a satirical joke about streakers or about whatever fad's happening. Zappa did the same thing. Now, what the serious literate philosophers didn't understand is that there was a turnover of fads, but they weren't fads. They were responding, the people were responding to different changes, rapid changes in technology. And that human nature now was becoming really bizarre because they had to deal with this endless change. So it's interesting that both McLuhan and Zappa were considered to be frivolous on what they emphasized as change.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, this is kind of what you found to be the your ace in the hole coming to the United States, you know, in that pop culture ended up ruling. So by looking at that surface, and looking at how it can be bent through frequency, through, you know, pictures and things, it ended up being a powerhouse. And so I can see why they would look at it. But then my question is, Bob, for Frank Zappa, knowing that and being also, he wasn't just an observer, he was a shaper of the environment. Well, what was his intention then?
He always, in the early albums...
What was his intention?
Yeah, no, this is what I'm going to answer. He always, on his early albums, on the sleeve, stated the basic Declaration of Independence or whatever the right, that particular amendment that guarantees freedom of speech, whatever that one's called. He always had this ridiculous, old-fashioned political statement from, you know, the 1700s on his album sleeves. And of course, he became famous for dealing with rock censorship. Yeah. So he was very concerned about what had happened to Lenny Bruce, who was a friend of his, or a late friend. And he considered Lenny Bruce a saint, and he said Lenny Bruce, he was going to make a Broadway musical about him. So here's Lenny Bruce arguing over trying to swear, and Zappa made a big deal out of this freedom of expression. So he wanted a society that could have more freedom of expression, and so he was almost a Wilhelm Reichian who thought that if people expressed themselves and had better orgasms, they'd be happier people. That's that Wilhelm Reich's idea. But Zappa also knew, that's why he'd be detached. What I just said, he would be detached about what I just said because he knew that the media society was taking over, the virtual society, and that nothing of these old humanistic agendas wouldn't work. So he was always mocking the very things that he appeared to be for. And so you would understand that he was for them in different contexts. So he had his long hair for many years, and then he had to go to go to Congress in 1985 to address the congressman. So what did he do? He did something that nobody could get him to do for 20 years. He cut his hair, and he went in all straight-looking. You know, real short hair. He cut. No one had ever seen Frank in short hair. And he walked in just to talk to Congress. He changed himself. He adapted to the situation and presented the appropriate image. I mean, that's the way he was doing it all along, very conscious of the medium of the environment and what his response would be. Now, he says through, when we talked to Ben Watson and Zappa came through, or Ion came through, and then Zappa came through, and Ben Watson hated the experience, but you listen to it, September 2nd, 2009, in my timeline, the main point Zappa is saying is that I wanted to bug people. I wanted to use sound to do things that would piss them off. So he sees, there you have little Joe in Joe's garage saying, I'm going to come up with some, you know, irritating, annoying notes to bug the executives. So he had what some people might think is a childish desire to aggravate. But as his interviews came out through the years and more philosophy came out, you realize that he was much like McLuhan, talking about an anti-environment, a manipulative anti-environment, and then satirizing being manipulative. That's why he flipped it and said, well, I'm going to be real responsible and run for president. So Zappa, like McLuhan, was quadriphenic, and you have to understand what quadriphenia is, the figure-ground relationship. So what is shocking people over the last few years, as a matter of fact, there was a documentary where they just took all his interviews and things that people didn't know about, and they presented it in Sundance a couple of weeks ago. And so the articles came out and said, holy shit, this guy was incredibly different from what we thought he was. There was this guy who could talk in depth about all kinds of topics. So Zappa the philosopher surfaced a few weeks ago, the deep Zappa that people did not understand. And Zappa also parodied the fact that if he looks stupid, people would think he's stupid, so he satirized the effective imagery on himself. He sacrificed himself to look like an idiot and then fool them. It's like Marcel Duchamp making an artwork secretly for 20 years. Frank made a secret part of his thinking and art a secret for 20 years. Or maybe 30 years. See, so it's a very more complex thing. So that's what we want you to look at. Now, when you talk about the revolution in pop culture in the late 80s, I guess you may be talking about hip-hop. That is what McLuhan predicted. The group mind took over. So that Public Enemy number one and bands like that started to represent the black race and get political, or what was called political. Is that what you were saying the change was, Eben, in the late 80s, that's way different from what Zappa was dealing with in the 60s?
No, I was talking more about new wave and punk.
Okay. What was that? What was the meaning of it, or what point do you want to make?
It's like a precursor to electronic music today. It started going away from bands into, you know, much smaller electronic-based forms. And it's like what Frank unleashed with encouraging the freaks. They kind of showed up in the 80s in punk and new wave. And
did you know, Eben, let me respond to that. Eben, can you hear? Listen, I'm going to stop here now and then and respond to what you've said so far. Who inspired the punks? Johnny Rotten, when he came over in 77, 78 with the Sex Pistols, he said, I want to meet one fucking person. That's all I want to do here. And guess who that was? Captain Beefheart, the other guy in the Zappa agenda. He didn't want to meet Frank, but he wanted to meet Captain Captain Beefheart. Also, many punks quoted Zappa because the punks hated the way progressive rock took over and created these big stadiums. And they, like you said, Evan, wanted to make small rock, get back to human scale and partying, having fun with music and not getting this corporate bullshit. Well, the one guy who agreed and represented that movement was Zappa. They would quote Zappa. Now, Zappa, they would then say to Frank, these bands are coming out now in the late 70s. They're kind of doing what you wanted back then in the 60s, what you represent, and they quote you, and they you're your inspiration. He says, yes, but I would not put garbage bags on my body as clothing, and I would not stick needles in my face. Yeah, he separated himself from that aspect of it, but he said he could understand why they were inspired by, since he was anti-60s rock, and the punks were anti-60s rock, that's where there was a similarity. So the very thing you're talking about was inspired by Zappa and Beefheart. What do you think of that, Eben?
Right, right. I was saying that. I agree.
So what's your? But you said.
Yes, I agree. But you were just, you had made a comment. You had made a comment that things after Zappa were kind of, you know, I don't know, you made something that it didn't continue to improve. And I was thinking that things did improve. I mean, things just went on the continuum. And so that was just my whole point about, you know, punk and new wave and how the freaks came out and claimed their zone. And that's kind of like what you were saying, that Frank and Captain Beefheart helped encourage.
Yeah, I definitely am not saying that things didn't improve. I looked like McLuhan Zappa at the ground, and what caused the new fads, the new types of music. Zappa said that you just have to look at the drug of the day, the favorite drug in pop culture, and that'll determine the type of music, and he could track it through the 70s, 80s, depending on what the popular drugs were. But no, he would not, we're not... It comes to the point in the late 70s where McLuhan says any effort by the old establishment to hold back what's happening is impossible. There's too much decentralized electricity and electric environments to stop what these kids are expressing and all the other aspects. Zappa said the same thing in the late 80s. He said you can't have repressive forces stopping this situation. So it allowed everybody to... It looked like it was improving because there was more opportunity to be free, and it did get more expressive. And that would be naturally due to the technology. But Zappa and McLuhan were always looking at the ground that created the sense that there was more and more progress in expression.
Yes, and this was one of the things that...
The fresh stand upon the dissociative...
Just a minute, Roxy. Let's hear Eben. Okay, do it again, Eben. What?
Jazz in the early. Did Frank at all stand upon the free the free jazz? The jazz where these guys just came in unstructured, played off each other, etc. Because that's a feeling I get from his music.
Okay, dig this. Cecil Taylor, you know who he is? Eben?
Yes.
Kind of.
Cecil Taylor was the John Coltrane of piano. He's the guy in the late 50s, early 60s, was incredibly radical free jazz piano player. And he put out an album in the mid-60s called Unit Structures, UNIT. Zappa was so impressed with Cecil Taylor, he named his daughter after the album, Moon Unit. So he was, and celebrated.
Wow.
Yeah. And he celebrated the free jazz guys. He had Archie Shepp play with him. You'll see him in the Jazz and Pop interview. He's with Archie Shepp and Roland Kirk, everybody. Roland Kirk wasn't that abstract as Ornette Coleman, but Frank did it. And you always have to look at, or Frank supported it, you always have to look at what Beefheart is saying at the same time. Beefheart said that Charles Mingus would come and watch him play in New York and was jealous of the freedom Beefheart had come up with. So Beefheart could be seen as competing within the free jazz movement, what he invented. And, of course, that album was recorded by Frank. So you got to look at Frank and Don as these forcelings who are coming forward to upset every genre of music, but also to incorporate the radical developments happening in every form. So, yes, he – and Don – now, dig this. His main – one of his main musicians for years was Don Preston. And Don Preston was like born in 1930. These guys were old. In the late 50s, Don Preston says, he was a regular jazz musician. He went and saw John Coltrane play somewhere, maybe in Chicago or something. And after he was a sort of an acquaintance of John Coltrane, Don Preston, who ends up being a key player in Zappa's band, told John Coltrane he needed to loosen up. He needed to, whatever he was doing with Miles and whatever that period was in the 50s, he told John to loosen up and gave him advice. And so Don Preston says he got the ball rolling for Coltrane. Now, isn't that amazing? Another guy involved with Zappa.
Yes. Yes.
It may not be true, but Don Preston is a pretty prestigious musician, and he's not, why should he lie? He's in a jazz musician, so I think it's probably true what he said. So, you know, you have all these heavy things, as people aren't informed, are all circling around Frank. Okay, maybe Roxy. Okay, wait, you got one more thing to say, Evan, about that?
No, I think it's, I love the thread that you've laid out from, you know, his appreciation of free jazz to now.
Yeah.
I can see how it really shook some foundations and led to, so many different art forms, you know. He was a
right.
revolutionary.
That's right. To the degree, the freak out meme can be the ground, just as Ayn would say, Da Vinci is a ground for much that comes after Leonardo da Vinci. Zappa was a ground for so much experimentation all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The smarter kids, the ones who got into trying to do something different, always cited Zappa. And I played these guys, they call themselves Making Music with My Insane Friend, these two guys. And Ben Watson wrote an article on them, and I posted around you. I think you liked it, Evan. I think you read the article on these two abstract guys. What are they doing? They're celebrating Zappa's guitar solos. You don't hear many younger people knowing and appreciating Zappa's guitar solos. So these guys, and I played some of the songs, very abstract, ridiculous stuff in terms of old standards, but they recognize that sound, it can be explored in a whole new tactile dimension now, and so they're doing it. And Ben celebrating him, but the guy—it's the first time I've ever seen a rock young musician celebrating Zappa's guitar solos. They usually celebrate he's a great creator, great songs, general terms, but not the fucking guitar solos. So that was new.
Roxy,
I
love that song, and also what you played before it.
Yes. Now, you talk about the heart, the aggressive. Zappa did
you
pretty music. Okay, check your mic. We're not hearing you.
I'm sorry. There's a big delay when I talk. I'm sorry.
Okay, so what were you saying?
Okay. No, go ahead. I lost it. Go ahead.
Okay, it's time for Bert to speak, I think.
Yes, there's a lot. From what I've been reading and listening, interviews with Frank was, I mean, he may have been involved, but not directly as we assume most characters. Like what Evan said, that perhaps Frank was a groupie, but because I listened to a story that George Duke had on, Evan, are you aware that George Duke was inspired by Frank? Frank actually turned George Duke on the synthesizer, because George was just a classical trained pianist, and Frank pushed him to learn the synthesizer and actually to sing. So that's to show you another angle of how Frank pushed his people. And there's also a link of how Frank has a very link to Bob. But what Bob is doing is that Frank was very into individuals and expressing themselves. But I have a personal story from what I heard George Duke share on YouTube, whereas he learned about really the groupies, from what I gather, from the band members. And George Duke explains that the band, when they were traveling, always had this game that they played with who would get the booger bear. And they would have a certain, some type of head or something that they would put outside the door of whatever musician was standing, who would get the booger bear groupie in the gang. George explained is that one time somebody made a joke and put the booger bear sign in front of Frank's door, and they said Frank was pissed the rest of the tour that they did that to him.
What does the booger bear, what would you do with it? It would attract a groupie? What does it mean?
What it is, when they were playing night to night, they would only have groupies, George said.
It was the sign that they scored.
Yeah,
I didn't get it.
But it was the ugliest groupie.
Oh, okay. But what, they would put an object in front of the door. What's the object?
I don't know. It was a certain sign or a head or something, and who would score the night of the ugly, the booger bear in the groupies. And one time they put that outside of Frank's door, and it pissed him off.
Okay, but look, what is the point? What is like, the, I know I got the ugliest groupie, so I put a sign out of my room to show that I got it, and I know I got the ugliest. Is that what you're saying they did?
There was some type of circulation up there. Someone would decide who would get the ugly, and they would put a sign outside the door that that would be their score at that particular night.
And so they were insulting Frank that he got the ugly groupie, and he didn't like that.
Yeah, and he got pissed. He was pissed. Now, I don't know. George, it was very delicate when George explained it, but he said that Frank was pissed. He didn't say Frank participated or not, but he said that Frank was pissed that they did that. Because, I mean, just it goes back into tying what you were saying earlier, that Frank didn't really mix with the musicians. I mean, he did, but he didn't. And maybe that's how he discovered the whole phenomena of groupies, just based on what was going on with his band members.
Right. That's how he found out. You know, there's a very funny scene in 200 Motels where the band members are trying to find Frank, and they're saying, he's listening. He's always listening. And they go over to this beer bottle, and there's this beer bottle sitting there, and they go, hi, Frank. They decide Frank's the beer bottle, like he's taping them. And they go, hi, Frank. And they start saying, I did lousy today, Frank. I'll do better tomorrow. And they were all confessing to the beer bottle their various hang-ups about what Frank would think of them as screwing up on their tasks. So it's a hilarious scene. And then while they're yelling at the beer bottle or worshiping it or paying their respects, there's Ringo Starr dressed up as Frank Zappa in a rain detective raincoat off in the corner taping them. So they don't see Frank taping them, played by Ringo Starr. They miss that. They're looking at the beer bottle. So it's like Frank's an environment. He's the invisible environment, like Ion. They can't find out where he is. And on the physical level, he made sure that he wasn't near them. He made it like he wasn't taping them by staying at the other hotel, the other motel. He wouldn't stay. I mean, this is an interview with Flo and Eddie, who were in the band for a year and a half or so. They said the one big question they would like to ask Frank is, why didn't you hang out with us? That was still on their mind years later. They didn't understand what he was. He was CIA.
He ran a very tight ship.
You know, that, what? What'd you say?
He ran a very tight ship. I mean, he had
very tight ship.
Very tight ship. I mean, he said he trained those musicians to entertain, but they always knew there was a plane ticket to send them home if they didn't do what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, that's right. It was just like the Marines. And he would have pictures.
Yeah.
Sometimes it would be he'd either put them an image of the mothers as Marines or Hell's Angels. He'd play it off depending on who the context was. But it's just like Sonny Barger that we heard Ion quoting earlier. Sonny Barger, the leader of the Hell's Angels. So Frank was satirizing the gang mentality that was taking over, and he, as an individualist literate genius, was up against this mob mentality all around him. That was one of the part of the dilemma or part of the drama he was acting out. Like, look, Evan, look at the humor, just the humorous thing that he walks into a rock concert in front of a rock band and starts conducting. Nobody would ever do that in a rock band. Start conducting in front of them. So that's really anti-environmental. That's satirical. Are you there, Evan? You get that?
Yes. It's almost priestly.
Yes.
Yeah. He almost sounds a little priestly, like a priest.
It's exactly that, Evan. McLuhan used to say, he says around me and in the Monday night seminars, he said rock was the new shamanic religion. Rock was the new priest. That's why in the McLuhan quadrant, I call McLuhan Zappa priest. And McLuhan talked about guys would come in and read their literate poetry, and he'd just say, that's a lot of words. Where's your music? You've got to be a rock and roller to be poets today. And the literate poets would be shocked that Zappa, it would appear that McLuhan had defected to celebrating, you know, Leonard Cohen or something. And the literate poets hated that. But he said, rock music is modern poetry. This is what professors should be studying. And he demanded that the teachers test their kids on their favorite music or what they were listening to Top 40. He said, this would turn the kids off of this music. If you seriously want them to study Shakespeare, you don't test them on Shakespeare. You test them on the Beatles so that they get pissed off you're testing that shit, and they'll stop listening to it, and then they might read Shakespeare. That was McClellan's whole agenda. He knew no one would do it, but he was stating his anti-environmental position. Zappa was doing the same thing. He was looking at rock poetry and figuring out how to make it a more comprehensive poetry. And he was doing it like a religious figure. And he eventually did form a church called CASH.